Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
I'm Faisal Carmelli, my co-host here, Dave Popowich. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Faisal. What's going on with you?
Nice little weekend, getting a little bit of time with the family, digesting what's happening with this budget that we just got.
Can I wish you a happy birthday publicly?
You just did.
Oh.
Thank you, sir.
See who's listening, right?
Very nice of you.
Yeah.
To remind people that I'm older.
Well, you haven't quite caught up to the right decade yet, but you're getting there. You're moving in that direction.
You say that every decade.
trying to drag you up with me, I got to say. Misery loves company.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. It's misery at that age? I don't think so. In fact, when you look as you start to age, your happiness index goes up.
Actually, yes.
It bottoms around your 20s, late 20s to early or late 40s, let's call it. And then it starts to pick up. So the older you get outside of your 40s, the happier you feel.
Yeah.
Is that interesting?
Well, yeah. But it makes sense. You think about some of the complexity of that time in your life, right? What you're dealing with. And there's a lot of pressure on people at that point in their lives with families and work and, you know, aging parents and so on and so forth. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm still dealing with some of those big issues, but we will get through them all. And eventually, you're right. I would think that, it gets easier.
And what people are feeling right now is what we're going to be talking about on the show today. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about the federal budget, in particular, one area. We're going to talk about how this capital gains tax change may not only impact the so-called ultra wealthy or rich people.
Yeah, I think that's overstated for sure. We'll cover off some very interesting examples of that. And also, I think we need to talk a little bit about what people can do and what they're thinking about, strategies, and give some general guidelines, because there's always things you can do and adjust. And ultimately, tax changes happen all the time, and we need to be able to be flexible enough to do that.
I think the markets have also looked through this geopolitical risk that we're having as well.
Well, do you think so? I mean, the oil markets have bounced around a little bit, obviously, for that. But it has been an interesting week, and it's been an interesting April, I think, in market trading, right? You've got some conflicting things going on.
If you take the broader index, let's say the S&P 500, it has retraced about half of what of its gain for the year.
Yeah.
And that's a pullback. That's an official term of a pullback. If you think it's more than 5% of a drop, it's a pullback. So that's where we're at. This will start to cause people, especially when they get their statements or they look online and see what their portfolios are doing, they're going to go, uh-oh. And then they're going to tie it to the geopolitical risk. They're going to tie it to that interest rates are still high or higher for longer. And that's going to cause a bit of concern out there when it comes to, are we going to give up all of our gains for the year, or where are we headed?
Right. And, you know, when things change creates churn, right? So, there might be people who are rethinking sort of what they think about interest rate cuts and so on and so forth, and they might be repositioning. So anytime you get that, you're going to get some churn in the market as people, companies, institutions start repositioning themselves. So you have to expect that. We've had 5 good months in a row. Right? 5 good months of gains in a row. So it doesn't go straight up forever. Do you think this is normal volatility?
Normal volatility for an abnormal time.
Right.
And so why I say that is because you've got the geopolitical risk happening, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Iran now. You've got the interest rate issue and inflation still being, the word sticky is being held. Mm-hmm. But when you look under the surface, and it's and I'm going off memory, Dave, so bear with me on this. About 15% of the S&P 500 companies have reported their earnings. They're generally higher than expected, so they've surprised to the upside. The companies who have both beat the top line revenue and their earnings have been rewarded slightly.
Right.
The ones who miss get hit harder. If you miss on both the revenue and the earnings, you're getting hit harder. And so you're not getting a lot of love for doing something right.
Right. And the forward forecast, right? I think that's going to be very important in this particular quarter.
Yeah, forward forecast. There are some tech companies who didn't give the growth numbers that the markets were looking for. They got hit early. But what you're also seeing is that other companies outside of the mega tech areas are starting to report some pretty decent numbers. Yeah. Consumer discretionary, consumer staples, so on and so forth, are starting to pick up. That means we're widening out the economy and in regards to what's doing well. That being said, the backdrop of geopolitical risk and interest rates is a reason why the darlings of the market that have done well on the top line and the bottom line have not been rewarded substantially.
Right, right. I think we've just, the backdrop, use that right word, the underlying, there's this underlying fear that's sort of gripping the market. And, you know, we always talk about markets are driven by emotion, okay, just like people are. So it's the collective emotion of investors. And right now the emotion is, we've got some concerns, and you're seeing that reflected in the trading.
Here's what I think is also happening, and it's not every single company. There is a bunch of companies out there. We've had credit card companies report. We've had some tech companies report, and man, they're looking good.
Yeah.
And the market is keeping the value of these companies pretty much in line to where they were, let's say, a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But the analysts are revising up.
Up. Yeah, you're right.
And they're not getting the love yet. So this is what I find very interesting, is that there are times where the market is giving too much credit to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then there's the time where the markets are not giving enough credit. And the market's not right in a short period of time. The market is right over longer periods of time. Right. And I think this is a point where selective investing, looking at companies that are growing the top and bottom lines, gaining more market share, eliminating competition, are the ones who are going to continue to prevail. Now, that doesn't look good because it's going to be less and less companies in that place. That's how we got to the Mag 7, or Nifty 50 in the old days in regards to investing, is that there's a few companies that lead the pack. And so trying to figure out which those companies are going to continue to be is going to be the biggest challenge. Those people, investors, money managers who can do that will be able to get better growth numbers. When you're transitioning to living in retirement, do not assume that a well-growing company is not right for your portfolio.
Oh, right.
And do not assume what's old economy type of company is right for your portfolio. Right. It has to be specific to the growth objectives of your portfolio and your retirement plan. So I think a lot of people are going to be talking about this, and they're not going to realize how much risk they're taking on. So I think that's where we sit in the markets today. And I think this show is going to be all about an interesting change that's happened. People are looking for growth, but now, I'll tease it a bit. You get penalized for growing your portfolio.
Are you talking personally? You're talking individuals.
Individuals,
right? Yeah, or corporations.
You get penalized now. And we'll talk about this more. We're going to have, we're going to have a member of parliament join us. We're going to talk about the budget. We're going to have tax experts talking about the budget and some strategies around it. I think you and I are going to have a great conversation with these guests on what's really happening in Ottawa, mm-hmm. and the directive, and what's happening in the field, let's call it, with Canadians.
Well, I've got some real issues with the budget in terms of its direction and what it says. And I want to, they presented the budget as though it's just taking from the ultra wealthy. I have to tell you, and I want to share the experience in our fourth segment about the very first conversation I had when I came back to work after the budget was announced. And it was not who you might impacted.
It wasn't an ultra wealthy individual who's, you think of, when you start thinking ultra wealthy, you start thinking of, these big business moguls.
Yeah, CEOs that are making millions of dollars a year. And it's
not them. It's 90-year-old widows.
Right. Yep. It's surprising.
It's 80-year-old retirees.
Yep.
It's 50-year-old people who just inherited money or inherited an asset.
And you and I had a great debate, Faisal, and we both have slightly different perspectives on it, but I'm getting very frustrated again. We'll talk about this in more detail 100%. about what this means for Canadians.
And that's why tax is going to be the biggest expense you're going to have throughout your retirement.
You want to talk budget and tax?
Woo! You ready?
Yeah.
You're heated.
I'm heated. Yeah, I'm frustrated by this whole thing. Yeah.
So here's the thing. There's a whole bunch of parts of this budget that's come out.
Yeah.
One thing that's hit our clients, our listeners and viewers of this show, and to many of our guest clients as well, is the change in capital gains tax.
Yep.
And so I think we should spend some time around the capital gains tax and what it's designed to do with the budget. And let's get it from a tax perspective first, and then we can get into the political side of it after that.
Okay. We've got Brian Ernewine joining us, senior advisor at KPMG and Canada's National Tax Center. Nobody better to help us put some perspective on this. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the opportunity to join you both.
Well, listen, it's the federal budget's called Fairness for Every Generation. I might take offense to that, but before I do, I'm going to give you a crack at this thing. I'd like you maybe just to address the changes in the capital gains taxes that are happening, and then we can dig into some of that.
Very good. So it's a big change, first of all. I mean, it goes without saying when you see that the government's booked nearly $20 billion in additional revenue to it for the next 5 years. Effectively, it increases the capital gains inclusion rate from 50%. So today, 50% of your capital gains is required to be brought into your income to 2/3. So 66 2/3 of your capital gains going forward, subject to an exception, will be taxable going forward. So to translate that, for example, in Ontario, capital gains, federal, provincial combined, are taxed at around 27% today for the top income earner, an individual. That goes up to about 36%. In the Wild Rose province, you're a bit more fortunate. I think that your current rates are about, your top rate is about 48%. About or exactly 48%. So half of that today is 24. After June 25th, because there's a transition, that goes to about 32%.
And so one thing that was been mentioned over and over again by the federal government is that this budget and this change in capital gains only impacts 0.13% of the population. Is that true, Brian?
I assume it's true as they've measured it. There is a carve-out for the first $250,000 in capital gains annually for individuals and only individuals. So for a large percentage of the population, they won't have anything approaching that on an annual basis, perhaps over their lifetime. And so it does exclude a large proportion. My I guess, caveat to that or challenge to that statistic is that there's a lot of us who have perhaps a one-time gain that will be over that amount. It could be the family cottage, it could be the family farm, it could be some other asset. So although it only happens once in your lifetime, it might be, you know, given price appreciation we've all sort of felt on real estate in the last few years, you know, that cottage that maybe came from your grandfather or your father and has got a very low cost to you, and now just in land value might be worth $500,000 or $1 million. It's pretty difficult to sell that cottage, you know, by $250,000 a year. So you could end up being one of that part 0.13% for that particular year where you sell the cottage and recognize a $500,000 or $1 million capital gain.
This is the one-time issue that you're talking about that I think is going to be the biggest problem and the most conversation about planning. In our role as portfolio managers, we can trigger a capital gain because the stocks and bonds that we own are liquid daily. So we can just get out at any point in time. When you have an illiquid asset or an asset that you can't sell in portions, what's the conversations happening with tax advisors, let's say at KPMG and its clients, on what are the options that is presented in front of a person that they could do knowing that this rule change has happened?
Well, I think the government has made the necessary right decision in not trying to apply this change as of budget date. I think there would have been a lot of pushback if there'd been no opportunity, no window to think about sort of reacting to this. But the window they've provided is pretty short. It was 10 weeks as of budget day. It's getting now to 9.5 weeks opportunity to get the 50% inclusion rate for individuals without limit, for corporations without limit, but only until June 25th or June 24th, in fact, of this year. That's going to make a very hard decision for a lot of people. So let's say one of you have the family cottage, the situation I described. You don't look at the age or stage where you probably were planning to sell it next year. But if you were, or if you're thinking about it being 3 or 5 years out, there's a very hard question as to whether or not you actually accelerate that to get the lower 50% inclusion rate today versus paying a third more in 1 year or 2 year or 3 years time. And people just don't know. They haven't thought. They weren't thinking before the budget about whether they'd face this decision. So there's really going to be some hard reckoning, I think, that has to take place, and in a very short window.
The challenge will also come to middle income Canadians who have to make this decision. And I'm saying that because I would take the assumption that high net worth individuals have some liquid cash. Mm-hmm. So if you do have to trigger some sort of capital gain in this calendar year, you have some liquid cash to pay the tax bill. But if you've got the family cottage, or you've got a rental property, or you've got a commercial property that you've been, that you've owned, and you now have to trigger again, but you don't have liquid cash, now you've got a problem. You might have to just either what, suck it up or borrow the money? Like, are those the options for people who don't have that liquid cash available to pay, you know, 24% on or 27%, sorry, on the gain?
Well, it can be an issue. I mean, if you really are selling, if you can manage to find a buyer in the next 9.5 weeks, then you will have the cash. You'll have some proceeds from the sale. But if what you're striving to do instead is to trigger an internal sale, sell it to your children or sell it to your spouse in order to trigger the realization at current capital gains rates, then you run into the liquidity problem you described.
How much of this timing issue is just going to create basically a windfall tax, a one-year tax, you know, bump, revenue bump for the government this year? And is there anything, any merit to the idea that that's part of what, you know, part of what the government wants to see happen is this triggering of a windfall tax to them?
Well, I think the government does expect that there will be some acceleration of gains as a result of this. I'm forgetting my numbers, but I'd mentioned there'd been close to a $20 billion 5-year revenue gain over this. Something like $7 billion, is their estimate, $6 to $7 billion, I recall, as being the revenue estimate for the first year from this, dropping to 3 or 5, and in fact dropping to a very small amount in the third year. I think it's only be fair to assume it's the view that there will be some people, and a large number of people, triggering capital gains on properties that they might be planning to dispose of in the next couple of years anyway. I will say that as between having made this effective budget day and giving nobody any opportunity to sort of take this action and what they've done, I prefer what they've done. But the part and parcel of the problem is the fact that they're taxing already accrued gains and giving people a window to pay a lower rate of tax on that than they might have to in a little bit of time.
Brian, let's turn the clock back. Let's say this budget wasn't announced and you're in the position to create the next tax policy. Knowing that there's a whole bunch of programs that your administration wants to put through, like the current administration, how would you have done the tax side of things?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not going to bite on that. I actually was in that role for about 35 years in the Department of Finance in Canada. But what I did was gave my advice to the political level and they made the decisions.
Fair enough. Let's turn on to housing. We've got another problem in Canada, housing. Your thoughts on the budget with respect to trying to help solve the housing issue?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that housing was probably the number one priority of this government. And I think that reflects the interests of Canadians. We actually did, KPMG actually did a poll before the budget of business leaders, and they also identified housing as the number one priority, which was interesting. But when you drilled in a little bit, you understood that they weren't just being sympathetic to sort of, you know, Canadian individuals. It's actually a business concern. Their ability to attract and retain talent depends on housing affordability. They either, you know, can't get the people they want because of the cost of living, the cost of home ownership or rental, or they have to pay a lot more in terms of salary costs to recruit and retain. So I think it's an important issue. I believe the government was right to address it, and I actually sort of see it as a productivity issue in terms of future growth and investment.
Brian, we've got to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to help dig into some of the details.
Appreciate it again. Thank you very much.
We've been joined by Brian Ernewine, Senior Advisor at KPMG and Canada's National Tax Center. You know, the proposed budget, the changes that came out potentially have a big effect on a lot of people. And, of course, not all of it will be positive. I think we've got to digest a little bit about some of the proposed tax changes. It may be how we saw the housing crisis in this country. And, you know, does the budget do that? Does it effectively help the average Canadian do this?
And for the record, I want to let you know that we reached out to the Liberal Party. We've reached out to the Conservative Party. And the only ones who could actually bring us a guest so we can talk about this is the Conservative Party. And so we are joined by Michelle Rempel-Garner, MP at Calgary Nose Hill. Michelle, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm a little bit flustered and frustrated with this new budget that's come out. A couple of reasons. One is the fairness for all generations. I challenge that one.
Yep.
And then also with this whole capital gains tax issue. Give us your take on what your thoughts are with this whole capital gains tax change.
So I'll just back up for a second, talk about the phrase that you just uttered, which is fairness for all Canadians. Just for your listeners who might not be aware, that's what the Justin Trudeau Liberals called this budget. And I agree with you. I think it's the most ironic title that they possibly could. It was almost like a gaslighting title because, a lot of economists, a lot of financial experts, and just everyday people were calling on the federal government to have a more prudent approach to spending because the levels of deficits that the Liberals have been running have contributed to inflation. There's a lot of people across the country who would like to see interest rates come down. That is not going to be possible without getting inflation under control. And a lot of people are saying that the budget doesn't do that. It does the opposite and therefore puts more burden of, expenditure, cost of living, future debt on every generation. So I think it's important to contextualize the conversation on what's in the budget from there. There are a lot of people who are upset about a lot of the measures that the budget contains. Certainly the one that you just mentioned, there's been a lot of commentary, not just in the media, but certainly I'm hearing about it in my inbox as well too. At a really high level, the government should have been able to explain why imposing this sort of measure on Canadians was necessary. And I feel like there's really little that they can lean on to do that, which is probably why you didn't get a liberal guest today. There's not a lot in the budget that is going to deliver material results on some of the big issues that you mentioned, housing, for example. So certainly I think Canadians have a right to be concerned, and there are many people, I'm sure you've heard from them in the last couple of days, who are speaking up about this. And as you said, you're digesting it. I think we're all digesting it too. And there's going to be a lot of, I think, very vigorous debate about this in the days and weeks to come.
When you look at the commentary of it, was 0.13% or the top 0.13% of Canadians are going to be impacted. We just had KPMG on the show right before you, and they were saying, there's a lot of Canadians who are going to have this one-time capital gain. They've got a rental property. They've got they've inherited cottage, property yeah. from their family members. They have commercial property. They've got a portfolio that they haven't sold in decades. And now they're going to trigger at some point in the future and welcome to a 33% increase in the amount of tax that they were paying to now what they will be paying after June 25th. This is not just the 0.13. It might be the 0.13 this year.
Well, yeah, the 0.13, I assume that was referring to the top income earners in Canada. And that is not true. There'll be far greater number of Canadian families caught in this versus those high income earners.
Which goes to my question to you. What would the Conservative Party do if it was your chance to build this budget? What would you do with the capital gains tax, for example? Would you have done the same thing? Would you have increased it and had thresholds like 250,000? Like, what would the Conservatives do in this situation?
It's a great question, but we wouldn't have been in this situation. You have to remember that, like, when Justin Trudeau came into office in 2015, he inherited a balanced budget and the economy was strong and growing. That is, putting it mildly, that's not the case. Rents have doubled. Taxes of all sorts have doubled. We have a national housing crisis. We have a productivity problem in the economy. So, like, I don't think it's fair to say, like, what we would have done if we wouldn't have spent like Justin Trudeau had in terms of just waste and irresponsibility. So, but I can tell you what we did ask for in this year's federal budget to make life a little bit more affordable for Canadians. We had three top asks. There is a bill in front of Parliament that would eliminate essentially the carbon tax on farmers and food. We asked for that passage. We pushed for my party leader, Pierre Poilievre's plan to incentivize the building of more homes. We asked for the cap on spending using a dollar for dollar rule. So bringing down interest rates by essentially saying, if you're going to spend something new, it has to come from an already allocated pot. None of that was in the budget. So, you know, in terms of what we would do going forward, we have been laying out these, our planks of what I'm sure will eventually be a campaign plan. But we were hoping that the Liberals would listen to some of the advice, particularly on removal of the unpopular carbon tax and an effective carbon tax, because we know that that would have made life more affordable for Canadians.
Knowing what the rules are now, if your party becomes the party leadership next year, will you reverse the capital gains tax? Is that something that's going to be on the table?
Well, I think it's important for listeners to note that even though the Liberals have tabled the budget, it hasn't passed yet. And there's been many scenarios where they've had to backtrack on measures due to public outcry. So I think it's important for people listening to this show to feel a sense of agency. And as certainly we will be opposing the budget at a very high level because of it didn't meet our list of demands. And we don't think that overall it's a healthy economic plan for Canadians. But I would encourage listeners that as the debate starts on the budget, it has started, it will continue in the next few weeks, to really just continue what we've seen in the last 48 hours, raising their voice, writing op-eds, writing to their members of parliament, and particularly putting pressure on Liberal members of parliament to make them understand how much this will impact their lives. That makes Parliament's job, it makes it easier for us to raise those concerns when they are voiced in the public as part of debate.
Michelle, if we can jump to housing for a moment, you used a key word, incentivize. Faisal and I debate this all the time. There's different ways to try to achieve this objective. I happen to be in favor of incenting. You know, you got to ask yourself the question, if we're 10 million, by estimates, 10 million units, residential units behind in this country, why is capital not going to that area right now? So I'll throw it back to you. If you could expand on this idea of incentivize, what is the conservative platform for trying to, get capital into that space and build the necessary housing that Canadians need to can afford for their lifestyle?
Well, there's, probably no better way to stop the flow of capital than to put bureaucracy in front of it, right? And we know that in terms of permitting home building of all type, Canada is one of the most overregulated places in the world. Certainly, there's a lot. It's more difficult to get a permit to build a residential dwelling in Canada than many other OECD countries. So our party's platform has been and will continue to be to do things like requiring cities to permit 15% more homes building each year as a condition of federal funding, receiving federal infrastructure funding. My party leader, Pierre Poilievre, he took some heat in the media. He was in Montreal and he pointed right at a city mayor and said, look, you're standing in the way of building these homes. There was a residential building project that could have put a lot more homes in the field. It was very well accepted by the community, but the permitting process is so long, it's so onerous. There's so many roadblocks that developers' capital, to your effect, will just say, well,
why bother?
Anybody who runs a business understands that you need to have a clear regulatory process, understands the cost, and more importantly, understand timelines in order to take that risk of putting that capital into a project. So we've been starting from a very firm understanding of that perspective and also, putting our money where our mouth is and saying, we want to streamline and reduce that regulatory burden because we need to put people into houses as quickly as possible.
You know how you get 10 million homes built? Increase the amortization for new built homes. Increase it to 30 years. That's going to create the supply, not increase the demand. Okay. This is where I get frustrated, right, Michelle? I think we've got too many ideas to incent the buyer, but not enough incentives for the seller. We need more selling incentives. If you look at that to build, but also to sell.
Yeah.
Because if you have more selling incentives for builders, they're going to create a great return. Dave, you and I had a real estate project that our hands were in on, and it was not in Canada.
Right.
the rates of return in Canada are not as lucrative as they are outside of Canada. As our fiduciary responsibility to our clients, we have to look for the best opportunity. Why isn't the federal government doing the same thing? So, Michelle, I bring that to you. Why do you think the federal government's not bringing those types of incentives where, you know, individuals like Dave and myself who are out there looking for investing for our clients, we're not picking Canada because there's better opportunities south of the border or elsewhere. Why do you think this government does not? We only have 30 seconds. I know I'm loading up that question for you.
Just listen to your frustration, right? Your frustration is expressed by millions, tens of millions of Canadians across the country, almost regardless of political stripe. And why? Why? It's because this is a government that is out of steam. It's not providing strong political direction or policy. It's rehashing policies that have failed over 10 years and expecting different results. And, you know, I just think that, you know, the change in, you know, political opinion in the country over the last year is indicative of that. But this has real life results, as you just rightly expressed. So, you know, you're right.
The one thing I think that Michelle mentioned is there's agency out there. Make your voice heard about the problems with this, because we haven't got royal assent yet. There is an opportunity for the government to backtrack a little bit or change a little bit, as has been done in the past. So I thank you for your time, Michelle, Joe, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Michelle Rempel-Garner, MP at Calgary Nose Hill.
Been in it. Interesting and exciting show, my friend, and I'm frustrated.
Okay? Yeah, I was going to ask you. You feeling okay?
Yeah, no, I am frustrated, and I don't know if we're going to be able to do it justice in the time we have here. But you know, the budget was presented for a new generation and share the wealth and all this stuff, and it's only going to affect the top 0.13%. And I have to tell you a quick experience. The very first conversation I had when I got in the morning the next day after the budget was announced was a young woman approached me and said, "Dave, my grandmother, who's 90, okay, has now a tax problem." So her grandfather, since passed away, worked at in Saskatchewan at Potash, started in the mailroom, was just a good old-fashioned working man for his whole life. And what they did is they saved money as they were supposed to do, live beneath their means, save so they could take care of themselves and their family. And with what little they scraped together over the years, each year they put it away and they were buy and hold people. And now grandma's 90 and she has a big embedded capital gain just because they've owned good Canadian businesses over time, okay, as they've set money aside. And the impact on this to her is the tax change is going to cost her grandmother, between $140,000 and $150,000. And it begs the question, okay? It begs the question at this point in time, should she have saved any money at all? Are we becoming a nation of handouts?
So this is what the arguments on both sides of the fence are saying. If anybody, and let's pick on grandma here, grandma is now a multimillionaire or a millionaire at least.
Yep.
Okay. So she's a millionaire.
Yep.
Pay some more tax.
Right.
That's the argument. Okay. And I think that's where the problem comes into play, is that who are we trying to take from, right, and who are we trying to give to? And when you look at this, I don't think it's a disincentive to save. I think it's a disincentive to invest. Had grandma and grandpa tucked their money in their mattress and made zero rate of return, they would, and they were still able to save $1 million, $2 million, then they would be multimillionaires, but with zero tax issues, because all the money's in their mattress.
But remember, they wouldn't have a million or two because it wouldn't have grown. Okay, so great. Now we're disincenting people not to save, according to you, and I'm going to come back to that, but not to grow it. Okay, so now it just sits and it does nothing. What in the hell is the reason for either of those things? You may as well, if this was 50-year-old granny and we knew all that's going to happen is you are going to continually apply more and more wealth taxes, success taxes against people that do what they're supposed to do to take care of their family.
So I'm taking a little bit of a less stance on this one from the people I've been talking to on the other side of this argument.
Okay.
This is not my argument. This is not our team's argument. This is the other side of the argument, is that grandma could still save.
Why? Why save? Because she can't make money.
Because when it comes time that she'll need the money for other things.
Why? The government will give it to you.
Then you lose out on the capacity of choice. Let's take that grandma needs help in the home.
Mm-hmm.
She needs care.
Government should do it. Government will provide the care.
We've been doing this show for 16 years, the government does not pay 100% of those costs. There's going to be an out-of-pocket expense. And if you don't have it, then you're going to be even more of a burden to the taxpayer because you're going to be in the hospital.
Why not
in
be a receiver? That's my question. Why not be a receiver? Why be the, you know, we've got it. We need a strong middle class. Please don't understand. Nobody misunderstand the fact that every economy needs a strong middle class. You and I debate this all the time.
100%.
You have two choices. You can take from people that are successful and you can give to people that are lower in middle class, hoping that they're going to become middle class.
And that's the point that you just said. You said successful. Here's where I have a problem. When did we define what successful and not successful is?
Right.
I don't understand. What's the line? Apparently, if you make $250,000, you're now in the rich category.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you have $1 million, you're in the rich category. If you bought an average home in major cities like Toronto and Vancouver, it's $1 million.
Right.
So if you were, and here's my problem with this. If you just did the job of paying off your mortgage,
right,
you're a millionaire,
right,
on paper.
Right. That very average Canadian family that bought a home, whatever, Vancouver, Toronto, 25 years ago on a modest income,
correct,
is now the definition of the ultra wealthy.
So I'm not, when we start talking about we're taking from one group, the successful that you said, and we're moving it to the middle class and lower middle class and below that, I don't know what the definition of successful is.
Right.
When we think of successful, some of us are thinking Elon Musk. Some of us are thinking CEOs of major Canadian corporations. Some of us are thinking the billionaires and people have got $100, $200 million.
Right. No, it's grandma. It's grammy. It's granny and grandpa that just saved, worked and saved their whole life.
Because we put the metric at $1 million. We can have $1 trillion economies, $1 trillion companies, but a millionaire on paper, right, owning a home in downtown Toronto, you're now wealthy. I don't think that's accurate.
Right.
I think where we target this level of the word financially successful has to move.
Well, and the approach that Canadians, I don't blame the government. I think this is a Canadian issue. Every one of us has got to sit back and say, what would we prefer in terms of developing a middle class? Do we want to take from somebody and give it to somebody else? Because I contend that when you receive something for free or perceived free, you didn't earn it, it has far less value than it has in the hands of the person that earned it. So we have a choice. We can take it and give it to people, that's the free, or you can incent those people to become middle class by taking risk, working hard, and earning it.
And that's what we want to hear from you. Is it better to just move from one group of people the money via a tax system to help the middle class and below middle class, or is it better to incent people? We'd love to hear back from you. We're going to be having our seminars in Lethbridge on May 7th, 7 p.m. in Calgary, June 4th, 7 p.m. You need to register for both. Go to morethanmoneyradio.com to register. That's morethanmoneyradio.com to register.
All right. I just want to thank everybody for indulging me in my little rant there. I hope we hear from you, and I hope it sparks conversation, right? I think we need to start having conversation about this in our country. All right. Thanks for tuning in for another edition of More Than Money on QR Calgary. On behalf of Faisal and myself, Dave, we look forward to chatting with you next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.